From the land of Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 15th day of September 2017. I'm Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Mike Zuzulo. He's a global commodity analytics and consulting out of Atchison, Kansas. Rodney Davis was on campus. He's the 13th district representative for the state of Illinois in the United States Congress. He sits on the Ag Committee. And he chairs the Subcommittee on Research. He's here to take a look at the RIPE project. It's all about photosynthesis and making it more efficient. We'll hear from him. And then as we close out our time together, we'll take a look at the weather forecast, too, that with Eric Snodgrass from Agrible. And we'll do that right here on this Friday edition of our agricultural programming from Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Well, you're listening to the Closing Market Report for this Friday afternoon. We're joined, as usual, by Mike Zuzulo. He's a global commodity analytics and consulting out of Atchison, Kansas. Good afternoon to you, Michael.
Good afternoon, Todd. How are you?
I've been really good. It's been a busy day here on campus. On Monday, we kick off the campus charitable fund drive. We call that the CCFD. I've been involved with them for a long time, and we raise about $1.3 to $1.5 million annually. We're at $1.5. That's our goal this year. It's a big number, but it's the 150th anniversary of the U of I. And I kind of hope that everybody on campus and that's involved with the U of I really gets involved, and we come through with it. Mike, you know, it's one of those things that's really gratifying, and that... I just get a kick out of doing it. And then, and we'll hear this a bit later in the program, I dropped out of that. I was emceeing an event to get folks started there. And over here to the Ag Campus, not very far from my office space. And Rodney Davis was here. He's a representative from the 13th District. That's out of Taylorville and covers a large area of Illinois. But he sits on the Ag Committee and the Research Facility Committees, too. And we talked to him about the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and a great big grant that they and a couple of others have made, $45 million. It's no small grant to take a look at photosynthesis and how you can engineer plants to make them more efficient. So we kicked that off. It's all about a reinvestment and all the kinds of research done here. So I don't know. I've been having a really good day, I suppose. However, I looked at the markets and I thought, dang, soybeans are down again. However, the wheat futures managed to gain a little. Tell me about what happened in Chicago.
Well, I think if you look at the weekly numbers, that is the bright spot when it was all said and done. I think we've had a lot of attention, rightfully so, put on the soybeans and the fact that we went down to that 937 area for a weekly low on the report day and were able to get to 977 for a high or thereabouts. And so we had a 40-cent range in the soybeans, so it made sense why we talked a lot about that. But if you take a step back, what really turned the markets after the report was the wheat. And for the week, we're up about 2.5%. Dease wheat, now lead month futures, tried to make a go at getting above 450. That's a pretty critical level that we need to get above, Todd, especially with a little bit more rain coming in to the hard red wheat belt on the forecast models today. That's probably why we weren't able to sustain that level. But 450 to 455 would open up the upside in the wheat and make me think, along with $50 crude oil prices, that those investment flows that we've been talking about shifting out of the equities and funds, managed money positions, covering their short positions, would start in earnest. They seasonally do in wheat. You usually get a real big short covering type event happen this time of year, going into essentially Halloween, three out of the last 4 years in the wheat. So wheat, to me, was the standout performer in the weekly price action. Crude oil broke out to the upside. That also very strong. Beans, very nice to see, but we haven't gotten above any technical resistance in corn, beans, or wheat at this point. But we certainly, I think, I would probably round it out saying we dodged a bullet with the USDA report with those corn and bean yields.
And we did post, technically, they posted an outside up week, too.
That's right. That's exactly right. So, I mean, that if I had my druthers, wheat leads, that's great news.
All right. So go back to Tuesday. Those were some big yields that USDA dropped out. And what'd you think of them?
Well, I, you know, it's interesting. One of my clients called me and said, did you listen to the Commodity Week last week of Dr. Hurt talking about the yields actually going up? I said, no, I hadn't. So I went back and listened to that. It made really good sense that nationally, based upon crop conditions, that that percentile that he was talking about would be a trend going higher. My biggest rub is the state by state. I, you know, Michigan is a biggie. Nebraska is a biggie in terms of crop conditions. And Illinois is probably the biggest. We came in a bushel higher, which I thought was very out of the statistical realm of possibility, because we're dealing with 56% good to excellent conditions in Illinois. That's only 1 point better than 2013 and 2015, when we had an Illinois state yield of 175 and 178, respectively, of those years. So we're running 10 to 15 bushels higher with essentially the same crop conditions and essentially the same 30 and 60-day precip totals versus normal. This is what, along with my farmer survey, makes me want to come in with a 165 and a half corn yield for the country when it's all said and done in January. I still feel very, very good about that, but I really question whether I'm going to use those crop conditions at all in my yield assessment between May and September. They're just not working, and they haven't for this is a third year in a row.
No, this is something I don't usually think too much about those crop conditions, other than they come out and they seem, you know, like they're on. But this year's crop conditions reporting was a little odd to me. So we'll see how it all turns out. However, USDA, given those crop conditions, is still finding in their objective and their yield surveys of producers a big yield. So the number is the number, and when it's all said and done, it's the USDA number, and that's what we end up with, and they're right one way or the other, aren't they?
Yeah, you can't fight City Hall, as they say. Now, that brings up a really big point. Even with that 169.9 yield in corn, we're looking at a world stocks to use number in corn of 19%. That's the lowest in 4 years, and it's actually 3 percentage points below where we were in 2015, 2016. So we had some good news in the corn this week, but the trade, I think, is much more willing because especially of the consumer or the consumption in the meal and in the processors and in the export for the soy complex and the continuation of daily reporting of sales to China. I think they're much more willing to bite into the idea that USDA could be more off on the bean yield versus the corn yield. Plus, we just have corn shelling going on 2 to 3, maybe even 4 weeks early. I went to Husker Harvest in Grand Island yesterday, and all throughout the state of Kansas and Nebraska until I got to probably an hour south of I-80, there was a lot of corn shelling going on. So we're running very early out here. I haven't heard a lot of yield reports. I can only imagine that we're not getting the test weights because we probably lost a lot of kernel depth. It was 100 degrees in Grand Island yesterday when I was up there. So I don't think that's doing much for the corn size.
Hey, only a little less than a minute left. The U.S. dollar, that down at 91.875, that son of a gun's starting to drop pretty low at this point.
Yeah, one of the things that's interesting about this year, Todd, is, and I think this goes back to the president's new administration, is with North Korea coming out again with the test firing of another missile, you had another situation where the dollar was sold off, not bought. And I think this goes back to the biggest fear I continue to have, the two ends, NAFTA and North Korea. If North Korea and China can't get their act together, in the Trump administration's opinion, we're going to have to isolate China more. So I think this is where the dollar weakness is actually helping us more than anybody thought, given the geopolitics. I think it's because we are targeting more of China.
Hey, thanks so much, Mike. Appreciate you being with us.
My pleasure. Get some rest.
I will. That, of course, is Mike Zuzulo. He's with Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting in Atchison, Kansas. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason. Well, the Senate Ag Committee has held a hearing on USDA's food nutrition programs and how they relate to the Farm Bill. On that subject, a University of Illinois agricultural economist thinks the divide between farmers and those using SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, sometimes called food stamps, should probably close ranks around a couple of issues, including governmental regulations. The U of I's Craig Gunderson says there's plenty of common ground for farmers and low-income households to plow, and it all involves back pocket issues.
One of the key ways we can alleviate food insecurity in the United States is to make sure that food prices are low. Okay, low food prices are extraordinarily important. So any barriers that prevent food prices from being low should be removed, whether it be unnecessary restrictions on where grocery stores can locate, whether it be unnecessary restrictions on farmers' ability to use GMOs. All these things, by eliminating restrictions that would impose burdens on farmers and the agriculture industry, would have a huge benefit for low-income households.
Eliminating unnecessary regulations is just one issue where farmers and SNAP users might agree. Open trade, says Gunderson, should be another.
Free trade, of course, benefits farmers across our country, you know, whether it be, you know, soybean farmers in Illinois or other farmers across our country, is that we really need free trade. That benefits farmers, of course. In addition, though, is free trade has huge benefits for low-income households in the United States. We know that limitations on free trade raise prices, whether it be prices of food or whether it be prices of other things. So let us promote free trade rather than impose restrictions on it, and that will have huge benefits both for farmers and for consumers.
The Farm Bill debate is underway in Washington, D.C. and around the nation. About 80% of USDA's budget is wrapped up in food and nutrition programs. Well, it's been a pretty busy Friday here on campus. Earlier today, political and agricultural leaders gathered to see the transformative work by scientists in photosynthetic efficiency. Actually, it's a project called RIPE that stands for Realizing Increased Photosynthetic Efficiency. It's a $45 million five-year reinvestment from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Foundation for Food and Agriculture Research, and the UK Department of International Development. Illinois Congressman Rodney Davis, a member of the House of Representatives Ag Committee, toured the research facilities, fields, and labs. I caught up with him. He says he was impressed.
Yeah, this was a great presentation, but really a celebration. It's a celebration of a public-private partnership, the Gates Foundation, we've got UKAID, we've got FAR, and also the University of Illinois and the USDA. This is why I enjoy being the subcommittee chairman of the Subcommittee on Biotech, Horticulture, and Research, because this research component means so much to not only the University of Illinois and land-grant institutions like it, but also it allows us to have money to partner with private foundations like the Gates Foundation to really do what is necessary when it comes to research and photosynthesis. Their goal of the RIPE project is to grow more food on less land, to feed more people years from now.
This can be done by breeding or engineering plants to take more complete advantage of sunlight.
Absolutely. It's about increasing the amount of yields by taking advantage of understanding the photosynthesis process better. And by doing that, we're able to address a global food security problem that we're going to have, that we currently have in the world right now. And it's only going to get worse when we have hundreds of millions of more people in the next few years and being asked to grow more food on less land. So we have to have new advances. That's what ag research does. That's what this public-private partnership does. And that's what we need to do.
Well, on that note, there's been more emphasis on research dollars from Congress this year than in the previous couple of decades. I asked the congressman why he thought that was the case.
Well, I'd like to say it's because of our leadership on the subcommittee, but it's because we've really tried to put a focus on it as a Congress, and especially as a House Agriculture Committee. It's not just Title VII, the research title. This is about making sure that we address global food security issues, and we do it by partnership projects and research projects like the RIPE project.
Rodney Davis is a member of the House of Representatives Committee on Agriculture. He was visiting the University of Illinois campus this morning to explore the RIPE photosynthesis research funded in part by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. The deputy director of RIPE, Don Ort of the USDA ARS, says RIPE has validated that photosynthesis can be engineered to be more efficient to help close the gap between the trajectory of yield increase and the trajectory of yield demand increase. Last year, in a study published in the journal Science, a RIPE team demonstrated one of these approaches could increase crop productivity by as much as 20%. You're listening to Illinois Public Media's Closing Market Report. I'm Todd Gleason. We're now joined by Eric Snodgrass from AgriBolt to take a look at the weather forecast. Hey, Eric, thanks for being with us. tell me about the forecast.
Well, Todd, we certainly have a lot to talk about as we approach harvest here. So let's get into the first big thing. And that is we've seen over the last about a week or so a pretty significant pattern shift in the overall flow of the jet stream. And what it's done is we've removed that huge ridge out west and replaced it with a trough that's developing this weekend. It's developing right now. And then a second pulse of that deeper trough coming across the western United States again midweek next week. And what that means is that that trough there is going to push a ridge into our part of the country here in Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, you know, and the Eastern Corn Belt and really the Great Lakes states. So while the Western states are now going to be seeing the below average temperatures, the Eastern states for at least the next couple of weeks are going to be seeing some warmer temperatures. Now, with each one of these troughs that kind of moves through the Western states, they're kicking off quite a bit of precipitation in some of the driest areas in the Corn Belt right now. I'm thinking about the Dakotas. I'm thinking about parts of Montana, really that north central plain sector. We might be seeing quite a bit of precipitation kind of coming through that area, at least yesterday, a little bit yesterday, today, and tomorrow.
Can you take that information and translate it into something a little farther out as harvest really begins to kick up across the Midwest?
We got some of the brand new model data that I've been kind of waiting for a couple of days, giving me a clue about the next 30 days. And there's kind of been a bigger picture transition we've started to notice across the equatorial Pacific. And you know that that is also the region where we monitor for El Nino and La Nina events. We've seen a bit of a change there. Basically, some cooler waters have surfaced. And as a consequence, we're seeing kind of the overall position of the jet stream responding a little bit to that. You know, the other changes in the jet stream have primarily been due to tropical activity in the western Pacific, which can influence the jet stream. So all of that points to this shift in the pattern. And what it looks like, honestly, is when we stretch this out, it looks like we might have, an end of summer and beginning of fall that's going to carry a bit of a warm bias, especially for the eastern Corn Belt. It may also carry a bit of a dry bias there as well, while the western Corn Belt looks to be wet and potentially cooler than average at times, especially in the northern, far northern parts of it.
Any frost or freeze worry in that?
You know, I don't see anything that would make me worry about a frost threat in the near in the coming days. I certainly would say differently if I were in Montana or in, you know, western North Dakota, but that's about the time they get a frost. So there's a lot going on, and it all has to do with the way that that pattern has shifted. Now, let's take a look at the other side of the country. We just finished dealing with Harvey and Irma, two incredibly powerful and destructive hurricanes. Well, right now, out in the central Atlantic, we have Jose. There is some uncertainty, but Jose may impact the northeast, so think New York, Boston, that area over the coming days. It's got quite a tough track to get there, but it might. There's some steering currents in the mid-levels that might push it into to land there. But following Jose, we have two other tropical disturbances that we're watching pretty closely coming across the open Atlantic as well. And so my point is, you know, we're only halfway done with this hurricane season, and the tropics are still quite active. But let's bring this back and talk a bit more about ag as we finish up here. Taking a look at Brazil, we are seeing some drier conditions, of course, as we always see this time of year in the northern growing regions. So think Mato Grosso. The southern growing regions down in Paraná and Mato Grosso do Sul and getting farther down south to Rio Grande do Sul and even to Argentina have been wet. And this is important because this is about the time where they're really trying to actively get in fields and get that soybean crop planted. The earlier it's planted, the better the safrinha crop would be, which is the second crop. So one of the things that the folks in Brazil need to keep an eye out on is what's going on with this developing weak, very weak La Nina, as it could perturb the Brazilian monsoon and kind of upset production down there. But if you'll let me here at the end, I want to stretch this thing out to winter.
Okay.
Some of the things that I'm starting to see in kind of some of our analog forecasts, as well as our long-range dynamical models, is that it looks to be that fall might carry a bit of a warm bias, maybe across most of the Corn Belt, getting all the way into December again. But we are seeing the pattern for this winter really transition across the northern states. You know, we've had some pretty warm winters the last few winters, but this winter looks to be returning back toward more what you'd call a normal winter. I certainly am projecting more snowfall than we had last year across the eastern part of the Corn Belt and definitely across parts of Illinois. But I think that our chances for seeing a colder winter, certainly colder than we've seen for the last two winters, is relatively high at this point. So that colder air comes in, that certainly has an impact on ag across the United States. And we'll be watching it and updating you every week because it's an important thing to think about as we transition out of our growing season through harvest and into our winter time. So with that, I think we got a lot to look at, but I'll wrap it up.
All right. Hey, thanks so much, Eric. Eric Snodgrass, of course, is with Agrible. He's from right here in Champaign. Helps us wrap up this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason.